Superhuman eyes. Accelerated evolution.
Welcome back to another episode of Superhumanize, where we dive deep into the spirit and the science of self-optimization and explore cutting-edge approaches to health and wellness. Today, we're incredibly fortunate to have a true pioneer with us, Dr. David Spiegel, Associate Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and the Director of the Center on Stress and Health, as well as the Medical Director of the Center for Integrative Medicine at Stanford University. Dr. Spiegel has not only shaped our understanding of the mind-body connection, but has revolutionized how we think about medical hypnosis. With over four decades of research, his work has illuminated the therapeutic powers of hypnosis, showing it to be a formidable ally against pain, anxiety, and stress. From groundbreaking studies on psycho-oncology to his eye-opening insights on how hypnosis can modify brain function, Dr. Spiegel's contributions have been nothing short of transformative. Dr. Spiegel is also the co-founder of the Reverie app, and his mission is to make the power and immediate effectiveness of self-hypnosis available to everyone. Dr. Spiegel, what a pleasure to connect with you. Thank you for making time for us today.
You're most welcome, Ariana. I'm delighted to be here.
I am so fascinated by your work, and you've done extensive work, particularly with hypnosis, which has notably advanced our understanding of its clinical applications. And I'm really curious, what initially drew you to focus on hypnosis within your psychiatric practice?
Well, actually, Ariana, it's a bit of a genetic illness in my family. Both of my parents were psychiatrists and psychoanalysts, and they told me I was free to be any kind of psychiatrist I wanted to be. So here I am. But my father was going off to World War II. He served as a battalion surgeon in North Africa. And he was doing psychoanalysis, which every good psychiatrist did back then. And at the end of his session, his analyst said, "Herb, would you like to learn about hypnosis?" And my father thought, he actually said something. What did I do wrong in the analytic session? And he said, "There's a Viennese refugee named Gustav von Aschaffenburg who escaped from Austria. He was a forensic psychiatrist. He happened to have a smallpox scar right in the middle of his forehead. And he noticed when he was interviewing prisoners that some of them would just fixate on that spot and then nod off. And so he got interested in hypnosis, alterations in attention. And when he came to America, he couldn't serve in the Army, but he volunteered to teach Army doctors how to do hypnosis. And so my father started using it for combat stress reactions, for pain control. And when he came back, he slid back into his analytic training and practice. And he was told by one senior supervisor that Freud gave up hypnosis, so who are you to do it? Remember, hypnosis is the oldest Western conception of a psychotherapy, 250 years old, started in Vienna with Franz Anton Mesmer. But it keeps getting dissed and ignored. And but he had a wonderful supervisor named Frieda Fromm Reichman, who said to him, "Herbert, what are you feeling so brittle about this early in your career about your reputation? You're going to give a course at the Institute in hypnosis because I'm going to take it." She put him back on the track. And for a couple of decades, he mostly did analysis, but was doing some hypnosis. And he would call patients and find out how they were doing. And the typical answer he got from his analytic patients, whom he'd seen three or four times a day, was, "I'm doing okay. I think it probably helped me. If you're looking for patients, I'll talk to my friends." It was not a great glowing response. But his hypnosis patients, whom he'd seen three or four times, said, "Thank you. I stopped smoking. I'm handling anxiety better. I'm sleeping better. You did so much for me." And so he began to think, you know what? It's a better investment of my time to focus on hypnosis. So he started teaching a course at Columbia, which I participated in, and shifted his career to hypnosis. And I got so interested in it that I took a course when I went to medical school. And the first patient of some 7,000 that I've seen since then was a 15-year-old girl in status asthmaticus, couldn't control her wheezing. The nurse said, "She's in room 342, Spiegel, go take care of her." And I followed the wheezing down the hall, and there's this pretty redhead, knuckles white, bolt upright in bed, struggling for breath. And she had been given subcutaneous epinephrine twice, didn't work. They were thinking about general anesthesia and steroids. And I thought, I don't know what else to do. I said, would you like to learn a breathing exercise? She nods. So I get her hypnotized. And then I break into a sweat because I realize we haven't gotten to asthma in the course yet. And I came up with a very clever instruction. I said, each breath you take will be a little deeper and a little easier. And in 5 minutes, she's lying back in bed. She's not wheezing anymore. Her knuckles aren't white. Her mother stopped crying. The nurse ran out of the room. My intern came looking for me. And I thought he was going to say, what did you do, Spiegel? That's terrific. He said, I want you to know that the nurse has filed a complaint with the nursing supervisor that you violated Massachusetts law by hypnotizing a minor without parental consent. I kid you not. And Massachusetts has a lot of weird laws, but that's not one of them. And her mother was standing right next to me when I did it. So he said, you'll have to stop doing this. And I said, oh, really? Why? He said, because it's dangerous. He said, you're about to give her general anesthesia and steroids, and you think my talking to her is dangerous? I don't think so. So I said, tell you what, as long as she's my patient, I'm not going to tell her anything I know isn't true. So take me off the case if you want, but until then, I'm going to do this. So he stomps off, and he has a council of war with the chief resident and the attending, and they came back with a radical idea. They said, let's ask the patient. I don't think they'd ever thought of that before. And she said, I like this. I want to keep doing it. And now she'd been hospitalized every month for 3 months. She had one subsequent rehospitalization, but went on to study to be a respiratory therapist. Mm. And I thought that anything that can help a patient that much violate a non-existent Massachusetts law and frustrate the head nurse had to be worth looking into. So I've been doing it ever since. Because, Ariana, it was right in front of our eyes. This wasn't something theoretical, what might happen if you did this for a month. It was like, there it was. And I've seen a whole lot of that since. And that's why I'm still doing it. That's why I built the app Reverie to make it as widely available as possible. And so that's how I got into hypnosis.
And we are so glad you did, Dr. Spiegel. And thank you so much for sharing this beautiful story, which not only shows the power of hypnosis, but the power of one individual, in this case, you, following their own inner moral compass and doing what is right and fighting for it. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
You have also done significant work to demystify hypnosis and to actually illustrate its scientific basis, particularly how it modifies conscious perception, physical response. And this has been crucial from what I've learned in transforming skepticism into accepted knowledge. And I'd like to know, Dr. Spiegel, could you elaborate on what the latest brain imaging studies reveal about the neurological effects of hypnosis?
We thought that being able to demonstrate things happening in the brain would be a way of helping bring it into the 21st century. And so we started with EEG, which is a pretty low-tech but effective measure of brain activity, electrodes around the scalp, and you use a technique that's called event-related potential. So you give a series of signals, like a shock to the wrist, and you record the brain's collective electrical response to it. And we took a group of Stanford students who were highly hypnotizable. We just gave them some electric shocks to the wrist and recorded the evoked response, and it's a waveform that smaller at a tenth of a second, bigger at 0.2 seconds, and even bigger at 0.3 seconds. And it records the brain's sensory response to the shock. And then we hypnotized them and said, your hand is in circulating ice water, cool, tingling, and numb. And the response at a tenth of a second simply disappeared. And the response at 2 tenths of a second, at 3 tenths of a second, was half as big. And they said they didn't feel it as much, that it was just, they felt their hand as if it were in ice water, cool, tingling, and numb, and they felt a little something, but it felt different to them. So they weren't just telling us that. From the beginning of the receipt of these signals, of the pain, the shock, they were reducing, de-amplifying the brain's response. It's not, the thing about hypnosis is it's not just the same thing's going on, but you interpret it differently. The brain changes how it responds to signals like pain. So then we move to a higher tech, more expensive and intensive way of measuring functional magnetic resonance imaging. And you get beautiful pictures of anatomy, and you can see the what's called the BOLD signal, the blood oxygenation in very specific regions of the brain. So you can see where the action is in the brain. And we took high and low hypnotizable individuals. We gave them hypnotic and non-hypnotic tasks. And we looked at what was going on in their brains. And when they were hypnotized, they turned down activity substantially in the anterior cingulate cortex. Now, Ariana, your anterior cingulate cortex is like a C on its ends, right smack in the middle of the bottom part of your brain. And part of what we call the salience network. It's a part of the brain that is an alarm system. So when you hear a noise and you suddenly say, what's that? That's the salience network doing its pattern matching and saying something doesn't match, you better pay attention. We're pretty pathetic physical creatures. Our survival depended on our ability to detect and react to threat. And we don't smell as well as other animals. We don't hear as well. We see pretty well. But if we don't react quickly, we don't survive. And so that tends to distract you. And so if you're having a kind of bad work day when, you know, you're trying to work, but you keep finding other things to do and you keep getting distracted, your salience network is saying, nah, this isn't so interesting. Do something else. In hypnosis, it's the opposite. You have highly focused attention. It's like looking through the telephoto lens of a camera with great detail. Have you ever gotten so caught up in a good movie that you forget you're watching a movie and enter the imagined world? That's what hypnosis is like. It's been called believed in imagination. And we found that the more hypnotized these people felt they were, the lower the activity in the anterior cingulate. So you're turning off the alarm system and focusing on what you want. The second thing that happens is we found higher functional connectivity between the executive control network, the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. That's the thing where we're actually conducting a task and planning it. It's the part of my brain that I hope is being used at the moment while I'm talking to you. Higher connectivity between that and a part of the brain called the insula. Insula is Latin for island. And it's an island of neural tissue right in the middle of the frontal cortex in the brain. And it's a mind-body conduit. It's how the brain controls the body, and the brain also has interoception. It becomes sensitive to what's going on in your body. So that sense you get in your gut when you're anxious about something, that's the interoceptive pathway. And in hypnosis, you're more connected to it, which means you're more sensitive to what's going on in your body, but you're also better able to control how your body is reacting. We did an experiment, Ariana, where I was working with a gastroenterologist and looking at eating and how hypnosis can control eating. And we had people come in first thing in the morning without having eaten anything and spend an hour in hypnosis eating imaginary meals. They would do a gastronomic tour of the Bay Area. And it was so real for some people. One woman said to me after half an hour, let's stop, I'm full. Yeah. And we found that an hour of that, there was an 89% increase in gastric acid secretion. So they almost doubled it. So that's hypnosis controlling the way the stomach prepares to get a meal that it's not actually going to receive. And you know that these hunger signals happen, and sometimes you're not sated even if you have eaten a fair amount. There's a lot of room for control and misperception, and hypnosis can help you control it. We then did the opposite. We had them go to a desert island where there was no food or drink, but just they were the sun and the beach and the sand. And they had a 31% decrease in gastric acid secretion. And then we injected them with pentagastrin, which is a hormone that stimulates secretion of gastric acid in the stomach. There was still an 11% decrease in the hypnosis condition. The capacity that our brain has to regulate parts of the body that we thought just did their own thing is truly remarkable. And so we found that's that control, executive control network to insula connection. And the insula is also part of the pain network. So it's part of the brain that helps to process pain signals along with the anterior cingulate. And so that has to do with both mind-body control and another part of hypnosis that the third finding is related to, and that's dissociation, that you put outside of conscious awareness things that are ordinarily unconscious. Now, we do it all the time. So right now, you're sitting on a chair. Presumably, you're not aware of the sensations in your body touching the chair. Am I right about that?
Up until the second, I wasn't. Once you mentioned it, there it is.
There it is, right. And if you had been, I would say we better stop the interview now. Oh, it's pretty boring. But so we naturally do it, but we're not aware of it because it's things that we're unaware of. So to accomplish absorption, you have to accomplish dissociation, put outside of awareness things that would ordinarily be in consciousness. Now, the third part of hypnosis is the thing that scares people the most. It's what was called suggestibility. this guy can dangle a watch and make me do anything he wants. And that's a misunderstanding of what really is going on. It's a capacity to suspend your usual schemas for who you are, who you should be. That's processed in the back of the brain, the posterior cingulate cortex, by the default mode network, or what I'm calling the my fault network, that when you're not doing anything else, you're just thinking about who you are, who you should be, what people think of you, what you were raised to be. And it tends to imprison us. It tends to keep us. And that's not always bad. Sometimes it makes you consistent with your beliefs and ideals, but sometimes it just keeps you doing dumb things that you've been doing all your life. And with hypnosis, you can suspend this kind of rigid idea of self and try out being different. So have you ever been to one of these awful hypnosis shows?
No, I have not. I've seen it on TV, but I have not attended personally. What are your thoughts on those?
I don't like them because they are misleading deliberately, and they also scare people about hypnosis. For example, these guys pretend that they can make anybody do anything. But the first half of the show is always filtering people in and out to find the 10% of the audience who are extremely hypnotizable. Oh, but they make it look,
Dr. Spiegel, here a question, because you've mentioned it a couple of times before, the highly my language skills right now.
Hypnotizable.
So the highly hypnotizable individual, and then the low hypnotizable people. What are the markers for somebody to be highly hypnotizable and somebody to be on the lower scale? And is there a way to amplify it if so desired?
Important questions. Their hypnotizability, the capacity to go into hypnosis when you're an adult, is a very stable trait. It's about as stable as IQ, surprisingly. And about 20% of adults are extremely hypnotizable. They get lost in movies. They see other people's point of view sometimes better than they see their own. They're very sensory, intuitive kind of people, experience over reason kinds of people. At the other extreme, we call them the poets. The other extreme, you have researchers, people who don't believe anything they don't see written down. They have to analyze everything. And about 60% of the population is what we call the diplomats. They have an experience, then they step back and reflect on it. So they can have it and use it, but it's less intense and overpowering than it is for the poets. And there's a 6-minute hypnotizability test on the Reverie app. You can take it and see how hypnotizable you are. The interesting thing is that most children are highly hypnotizable. Most 8-year-olds are in trances most of the time. You call your son in for dinner and he doesn't hear you. He's off doing what he does. And work and play are all the same thing for kids. It's a shame we make them grow up, because it's a very pleasant kind of thing. Through adolescence, we tend to develop what the famous psychologist Piaget called formal operations, where you value reason more. You like to reason things and give that priority to experience. And for some people, they lose some of their hypnotizability in that period. And by the time you're in your early 20s, it is what you've got. And we found, using functional MRI, that hypnotizability is correlated with the functional connectivity of the executive control network with the anterior cingulate. So if they're working together, that's a good team, because then the part of the brain that's determining whether you should really be paying attention to this is coordinating with the part of the brain that's thinking about something or perceiving something. And to the extent that they're coordinated, it's easier for you to go into a focused hypnotic state. And we've also found that highly hypnotizable people have more binding of GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid. It's an inhibitory neurotransmitter that is stimulated by benzodiazepines, by alprazolam and other anti-anxiety drugs. And so you've got your own little pharmacy in your brain that allows you to have the anterior cingulate cortex soothed by inhibitory neurotransmitters. So we have a whole system in our brains for regulating our arousal and anxiety. And that's correlated with hypnotizability. It's very useful for controlling stress, for helping people sleep, for that reason. So the final part of the brain imaging story is that there is inverse connectivity between the executive control network and this posterior cingulate cortex, the default mode network. And that's a really cool thing about hypnosis. The bad thing in the stage show is the football coach dancing like a ballerina. You think, oh my God, that could happen to me. The good thing is that he's trying out being different. And it wouldn't be my choice of something I would choose to be different, but it is indicating what we now know is cognitive flexibility. Mm. And we've done studies with high hypnotizable people and using a test called a continuous performance task. It's a standard psychological test. And the way it works is you have to solve a problem, but the rules for solving the problem change over time. And you have to figure that out, not from new instructions, but from seeing how your responses are leading to success or not at doing it. And highly hypnotizable people are better at that. They're more able to get the idea that the rules are changing now, I better change. And I think in part, it's that capacity to suspend your usual view of who you are and try out being different. So while I think these stage shows give hypnosis a bad name and scare people, there is actually an important message in it, which is if you just try out being different and see what it's like. And that can, and I've seen that happen many times in my office where people just get a whole different view of themselves and who they are. And they're open to it in a way that they're not usually. So, you know, just like this young woman I talked to with asthma, her experience of asthma is once it starts, it just gets worse and worse. I can feel my bronchioles constricting. I can't breathe. I may asphyxiate. I may not survive this. And then you get more anxious and it's like a snowball rolling downhill. She perceives what's going on in her chest. She gets more anxious. Her chest reacts to her increased anxiety and on it goes. And I was giving her an opportunity to try out being different, to say, you know what, here's a challenge for you. I think you can do something about it. And each breath you take will be a little deeper and a little easier. And she was able to suspend her typical reaction to these asthma attacks and just try out being different. And she interrupted that cycle of mind-brain tension that kept making things worse. And that's where hypnosis has tremendous power in helping people try out being different and see what it feels like.
Amazing. And this correlates to the kind of stories, the narratives we have about ourselves and how oftentimes they actually perpetuate certain situations, certain states of mind, of physical health or disease. That's truly fascinating. And I love the name you gave the default mode network, the MyFault network. I'm going to use that. That's really excellent. And a quick, I'm really interested also in taking the test you mentioned, yeah. Just as it's probably not really possible to assess it correctly right now ad hoc, but I have had the experience. So I sometimes do a little self-hypnosis just in my mind to fall asleep. Uh-huh. I'm usually out like a light before even a third of the self-hypnosis is over, and not necessarily because I am physically or mentally tired. I find it highly effective hypnotizing myself. I've not really made as much use of it as I could. Talking to you is definitely an inspiration.
I'm delighted to hear it. It sounds like you're at least a diplomat, if not a poet. And it is all you need to go to sleep is to turn off your arousal system, the fight or flight sympathetic nervous system, and turn on the parasympathetic rest and digest system. And so just getting your body comfortable. Forget for a moment about what's happening in your mind. Start with your body, not your mind. There are a lot of things that can get you stirred up. And some of them you can do something about, some of them you can't. But you can always do something about how your body is reacting to that. So you start there and work your way up. And that's what we do. And that's what you, I think, do. As far as your hypnotizability, yes, we have the test on the app. If you want, I could do the test now and see how hypnotizable you are, if you'd like.
Sure, let's do it. Yes.
Okay, good. So get as comfortable as you can. On one, please do one thing. Look up past your eyebrows. Keep your head still, but look up high as you can. That's good. Way up past your eyebrows, all the way up. And as you keep looking up, good. Slowly close your eyes. Close, close. Good. Now take a deep breath. Breath out through your mouth slowly and let your body float. Imagine you're floating somewhere safe and comfortable, like a bath, a lake, a hot tub, or just floating in space. And while you concentrate on your body floating into the chair, I'm going to concentrate with you on your left hand and arm. Right now, I'm going to ask you to take your right middle finger and move it over to the top of your left hand and stroke starting from the fingernail of your left middle finger all the way down along your finger, the back of your hand, past your wrist, up your forearm to your elbow. And as you do that, as you touch your left arm with your right hand, you'll feel a sense of tingling and numbness and lightness. And you'll let your left hand float up in the air like a balloon. Now put your right hand back, that's good. And let your left arm, it's now way up, but you can leave it there if it's comfortable, or you can rest your elbow on the arm of a chair or a table, whatever feels best for you. And I'm going to give you this instruction. Your hand will remain light and in this upright position even after I give you the signal for your eyes to open. Later, when I ask you to take your right hand, pull your left hand down and let go, your left hand and arm will float right back up to the upright position. You'll find something pleasant and amusing about this sensation. After that, when I ask you to touch your left elbow, your usual sensation and control will return. Each time you go into this state of concentration, you'll find it easier and easier to do, and you can use it to help you concentrate on what's important to you. Right now, we'll come out of this state of concentration together by counting backwards from 3 to 1. On 3, you'll get ready. On 2, with your eyelids closed, roll up your eyes, and 1, let your eyes open. Ready? 3, 2, 1. Good. Now stay in this position, please, and describe what physical sensations you're aware of now in your left hand and arm.
Feel a little tingling, a little pounding, yeah. Sense of blood, also sense of lightness.
Lightness? Is it comfortable?
Yep.
Does your left hand feel as if it's not as much a part of your body as your right hand?
It feels lighter.
Lighter. But does your left hand feel as connected to the wrist as your right hand feels connected to the wrist?
More. I have a sensation in the connecting the hand and the wrist.
Okay. Now, please take your right hand, pull your left hand down, and then let go.
Okay.
You're laughing. Okay. What happened?
So,
does that surprise you a little bit?
It's funny.
What's your experience of it?
It felt like it was just floating off and
comfortable there. So yeah. your hand is where it wants to be. Is that right? By way of comparison, please raise your right hand. Put that back down now. Are you aware of a relative difference in sensation in your left hand going up compared to your right?
The right hand took effort and control to get up.
But over which hand do you have more control right now, your right or your left?
I'd have to try doing something.
Go ahead.
I'll try grabbing the computer.
Mm-hmm.
It feels similar.
They feel similar. You have equal control over both?
Yeah, it feels like it.
Is there any sense in which the left hand just wants to be up there, unlike the right hand?
It feels the same.
Okay, try it again. Put the left hand down and the right hand.
Put the left hand and the right.
Put them both down. Put them both down and see what happens.
The left hand wants to get up.
There you go. So yeah. Let it go up. And so maybe you have a little less control over the left hand than the right. It's doing its own thing.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's fair to say.
All right. Now, please take your right hand and touch your left elbow and then let go. Now let go.
It wants to go in this position, which is odd.
The right hand wants to go up?
Yep.
The left, that's interesting.
Maybe.
What's the left hand feeling like? Can you put the left hand down now?
I can, but it still feels like it
still
wants to go.
Wants to go up. Interesting. All right, touch your left elbow again with your right hand.
Okay.
Open. Now shake both hands and tell me when the control becomes the same in your left and your right hand.
Okay, they feel pretty normal now.
normal now. So before you had less control, now it's the same. Did I do or say anything that would indicate there'd be a change in sensation or control in your left-hand environment?
No.
Did I say anything to you about your elbow or touching your elbow?
Just right now?
Anytime during the test.
I only remember when you actually incited for me to do it in the last 30 seconds.
I see. Okay, good. And did you have a sense of floating lightness or buoyancy in your left hand and arm at any time during the test? You did.
Very much so.
Did you have that sense in any other part of your body? Head, neck, thighs, abdomen, chest, all over?
Yep.
Okay, so you're moderately hypnotizable. Your score is 5 out of 10. That's enough to make good use of it. And clearly you had some experiences that I take it are not particularly normal for you. Is that right?
Yes.
What, like what? How would you describe what was unusual about it?
It was when the left arm just floated up, back up, the part where I started laughing because it surprised myself.
That's right. And that's, as somebody who teaches people how to change, mm-hmm. it's particularly enjoyable when not only do they change, but they're surprised by it, that they discover things about themselves, their minds and their bodies that they didn't think could be possible.
Yeah.
And that's what can happen with hypnosis. And the message is also, Ariana, that all hypnosis is really self-hypnosis. It's not something I do to you. What I'm doing is helping you identify and utilize an ability that your brain is wired to use, but we often don't know how to use it that way. Or we do it spontaneously, but we don't do it in a planful way.
I love that perspective and approach, Dr. Spiegel. I think that's also really crucial. And it goes, just to circle back very briefly to the stage hypnosis, where all the power is in the hypnotist, right? And he or she gets people to do things, which is difficult for a lot of reasons. And the beautiful element of this was also the surprise.
Yes.
that I observed. Could you share, maybe something comes to mind, some of them or one of the most surprising outcomes you've observed with hypnosis?
I had a woman who had bad obsessive compulsive disorder for many years and also had claustrophobia. She was deeply afraid of, she would wait. Her son was in the hospital. She'd stand in the lobby and wait until somebody else decided to go up because she was so scared of being in an enclosed space alone. And so she'd stand there for half an hour waiting for someone to go up with her. But she was diagnosed with cancer and she had to have a scan that included being in a tube in an enclosed space. And she said, I just don't think I can do it. I can't get in an elevator, let alone this tube, but I know I need it. She was moderately to highly hypnotizable. And I had her imagine, first of all, getting her body comfortable, floating, because she immediately gets tense. And we get in this snowball effect thing where your body's tense, you notice it, you think, oh my God, this must be really bad. Your body reacts to that and on it goes. So I said, I want you to imagine you're floating in a bath, a lake, a hot tub, or floating in space. So she decides she wants to float in the Red Sea, the Dead Sea. I'm sorry, not the Red Sea, the Dead Sea. And I wouldn't think that would be the first image I would choose if I was worried about an illness. But it is the case. I've been in the Dead Sea, and it's extremely salty, much more than the ocean. And so you float like a cork. You just, boom, you float up. And so that made her feel good. So I said, okay, you'll float there. But the next challenge was, but what about getting into that scanner? And she had a wonderful sister who lives in New York, who was endlessly comforting to her, would call her every day and see how she was doing. And they would visit periodically. And I said, I want you to picture your sister being standing there next to the scanner and giving you a hug before you go in. And she starts to cry and she says, oh, that feels so good. I said, so I want you to take your sister's comforting and support with you when you go on the scanner and get your body comfortable. And she opened her eyes and she said, this is the first time I ever thought I could do this, that I could, I have a way of doing it. And again, it's like with my asthmatic patient, there's an old Buddhist saying that when you see an obstacle on the road, it may be a signpost. And if you conceive of the situation, not of something that's going to make you scared and helpless, but something where it's a challenge, but you have a skill to handle the challenge, you can do it differently. My surprise was her surprise. And she came to talk to my residents about it. And she said, Doc, I got up here. I said, I'll meet you in the lobby. She said, I'll make it myself. And she did. She got up there to see us. So things like that can happen. And it's just, I love it. It's just wonderful to watch. And you can see people really making a change in their life and learning something about themselves they didn't know they had.
It is absolutely wonderful. And it also shows how hypnosis can extend the benefits outside of also what you mentioned before, pain management, which is something else that's really interesting, but how it can enhance cognitive and emotional well-being. How does hypnosis actually interact with the cognitive and emotional processes to improve mental health?
It helps you. There's one beautiful study was done by a research team at the University of Montreal, Pierre Rainville and his colleagues, where they took highly hypnotizable people and gave them shots the way I did in that ERP experiment. And they did a PET scan on them and they gave them different instructions. And one instruction was, while they gave them the shot, that your arm is in ice water, cool, tingly, and numb. And they got pain relief. And it was by reducing activity in the parietal cortex, the somatosensory cortex in the middle of the side of the brain. And then they did the same shocks, but they gave them a different hypnotic instruction. They said, the pain's there, but it won't bother you. And because pain is both sensation and suffering, and you can control both parts. So then they got pain relief, same amount of pain relief, only the change in activity was in the dorsal anterior cingulate, not in somatosensory cortex. So just the words you used in hypnosis changed the part of the brain where you reduced activity. So it's entirely possible. And I'll tell you an example. I saw a lovely retired nurse a few days ago who had the misfortune of getting on a stool to change a light bulb, fell, fractured her wrist, and then went to the emergency room, and she agreed to surgery from a guy who should not have been operating on her wrist, and he made it worse instead of better. For 11 years, she's had this constant pain, and she's tried everything, and it hasn't worked. And she was moderately hypnotizable. She got some pain relief from hypnosis, a little bit, but not a lot, less than I had thought she might. And it struck me, and in Reverie, we have four different exercises to help people with pain. One is sensory alteration, cool, tingling, numbness, or warmth. Whatever physically you do to give yourself relief from the pain, try it. Warm bath, cold bath, something else. Or moving the pain around to see if you can manipulate it in some way. Or dissociating, going somewhere else. Go to a desert island and leave your body here. It'll take care of itself. And the fourth is a bit different. It has to do with the suffering more than the sensation. Because it says, I want you to see if you can find a sense of compassion for your body. If your body were a little child that were hurt, would you get angry and frustrated with it, yell at him? No. You said, what would you do? I'd pick him up and give him a hug and soothe him. I said, okay, your body is doing the best it can with a bad situation. Try and soothe your body. And here was this woman, and her hand, she's got a wrist support on, and she lifts it up and she starts to cry and she's kissing her wrist. And she said, I've never done that before. But I said, your poor body is doing the best it can. And that was like a totally different perspective for her and what was going on. That what she was doing was amplifying the pain by combining it with her frustration at how much trouble it had caused her. And she was making it worse instead of better. And she felt better when she could just forgive her wrist for being vulnerable and forgive herself for having made a stupid mistake that a lot of us do and taken a risk she didn't need to. Mm. And she paid an awful price, but she was compounding the price by being so angry at her body for it. So sometimes just finding in your heart to forgive your body for being vulnerable and frail is enough to change your reaction to the pain.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense, Dr. Spiegel. And I only know from my own experience, the knock on wood, rare times I do get ill, it often is accompanied by a sense of frustration. And I'm a biohacker. I should always be healthy. How can this? And then I get over it pretty quickly now, but it makes a lot of sense. And I think many of us are caught up in that. And of course, we're stressing ourselves out, and then being in the state of stress is not conducive for healing. Something else that you talked about, which I find really interesting, is dissociation. Now, you talked about dissociation, for example, sending people to a deserted island just to get and dissociate themselves from a certain situation that they're not comfortable in or that is stressful or even traumatic for them. Now, the other way around, you have also done analysis of trauma responses, right? And how traumatic experiences can lead to a fragmentation of consciousness. And hypnosis can sometimes access and reintegrate that. Can you explore with us the neurobiological basis of dissociation and how trauma impacts the brain's functional connectivity and how hypnotherapy can help in reconnecting these neural pathways?
Yes. Thank you. You've been reading some of my papers, I can tell. Thank you for that. There, in the last few years, we've gotten some very interesting new data on dissociation. Now, people used to claim that it can't really happen. Could somebody be in a car accident and or be in combat and not remember horribly traumatic things that go on? And the answer is yes, it can happen. That sometimes we're overwhelmed and the best defense is to just put it aside. When you're facing a life threat, the last thing you want is the full, complete picture of what's happening. What you want to know is, what do I need to survive? And sadly, many, when children are abused or mistreated, they're confronted with a horrible situation of a person who's supposed to love and protect them is doing terrible harm to them, but they can't get away from them. And how do you maintain some semblance of sanity? You just divide yourself. And so I had a patient who would just go to a mountain meadow full of wildflowers when her father was sexually abusing her. And that makes a lot of sense to me, except that she wound up with a dissociative disorder and had difficulty integrating. So the goal is to help her integrate. She had one, typically these patients have some, the overt personality is usually excessively passive and unprovocative, but there's another one who's the opposite, who is angry and says, it's all your damn fault. You should have run away from home and gotten away from that bastard. You deserve it. And she came up one day with a very frightening suicide plan. And I tell patients with dissociative disorders, I know that you can't remember certain things at certain times, but if you're planning to harm yourself, I better know about it. And if I find out I'm not, you're going in the hospital. That's it. So this, she told me the suicide plan. And I said, you know, I'm going to have to talk to the other parts of you about that. And she shook her head and said, you can't do that. And I said, oh, really? Why not? She said, doctor patient confidentiality. I said, I don't think so. So I told the other parts of her, but that's how real the dissociation seems. Mm-hmm. And we've learned that there is now, interestingly, a pattern of rigid functional connectivity. So periodic flows of electrical connectivity between the default mode network in the back and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex in the front. So it's as though you have this rigid connection that partitions your sense of yourself. You're dividing the default mode, the my fault mode network, and rigidly keeping it in a certain position. So it's less fluid, it's less flexible. And that's the problem. It's not that people with dissociative identity disorder, what we used to call multiple personalities, really have more than one personality. It's that they have less than one personality. They're fragmented. Mm-hmm. And that periodic rigid connection tends to keep them from integrating experience into one concept of a person. And one of my colleagues at Stanford, Carl Dicerroth, he's developed a technique called optogenetics, where you can, in living animals and people, determine which neurons are firing when, or make them fire and see what happens. And he first did it in mice. He induced dissociation in them by giving them a drug called ketamine, that's a dissociogenic drug. And no, then found that when they were dissociating, they would not lift their paws from a hot pad, that they were acting dissociated. And he found this rigid connectivity between the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate. And he had a patient with a seizure disorder who had electrodes implanted to try and treat it. And he discovered that the same thing would happen to him when he was having a dissociative episode. And so when he was having this specific rigid rhythmic firing between the DLPFC and the posterior cingulate, he said, I felt like I was the pilot of an airplane who had left the cockpit and was walking in the cabin. which is a beautiful description of dissociation. So it was from man to mouse or mouse to man, and you got the same thing. So we're understanding more the neurophysiology of dissociation, and it may help explain why techniques like hypnosis, which can induce dissociation, is a way of teaching people to control it. One of the other experiences I had, I was then a medical student, I think, my father had a patient who had non-epileptic seizures. So this is somebody who suddenly starts to shake and seems to lose consciousness, but doesn't have a regular epileptic event. When you measure electrical activity in the brain, they don't have a seizure focus. Some of them do have both, but most of them don't have a seizure focus. And she would suddenly start to shake like this. And I watched him treat her. And what he did was, you can't tell people like that to stop doing it because they've tried. So you know what you do? You say, start doing it. I'm going to show you how to do this. And so he hypnotized her and had her remember the last time she had one of these things. And she started to have it again. And gradually she would learn to make them milder and milder. So she would practice inducing it and she would get better. So hypnosis can help because it induces dissociation, but it helps you learn to control and reorganize it. Mm. And that's part of the treatment. And so with people with dissociative disorders, I will help them move from one component of their identity to another, get them to talk to one another, understand one another, and gradually make the dissociation less extreme.
That also makes a lot of sense. And it brings my thought to, I just mentioned, you spoke about ketamine. I know ketamine very well. We actually work with it. We offer ketamine IV treatments at our clinic, Gateway Clinics. Mm. And I'm really curious about have you had experience of combining hypnosis with ketamine IV therapy, or have you heard of it? It sounds like that could be a really powerful combination.
I've heard of it. It could be. We have not yet done that, but there is clearly an overlap between dissociogenic drugs. Some of them, like psilocybin and MDMA, you get this kind of dissolution of personhood, that you just experience things without feeling like it's my experience. And people come away with that with a very different view of those things. Even without, once the drug is gone, they still feel I could face something I couldn't face before because I saw it for what it was, not what it meant for me. And hypnosis gives you a kind of suspension of personhood where you just try out what it's like to be different. So it's less extreme, but can be, I think, very effective as well. And we have just published a study in Nature Mental Health where we use transcranial magnetic stimulation in collaboration with Nolan Williams, my colleague at Stanford, to trigger connectivity between the DLPFC and the dorsal anterior cingulate. And we found that we could transiently improve hypnotizability. So we're hoping that this was a pretty brief experience, but we're hoping that we can find ways to enhance people's ability to suspend their self-consciousness and make them more open to and able to use hypnotic-like techniques to control some of the problems that we've been talking about.
Excellent, because that was also one of the questions I have. How can you actually support people who are not very hypnotizable?
Right.
And I would like to go into, perhaps, I know a lot of our listeners and viewers are, as myself, very much into applying things into their own lives.
Right.
Your research, for example, it extensively covers the impact of stress on physical and mental health. And you advocate for effective management strategies. I would like to know from you, Dr. Spiegel, what are some immediate techniques that people can implement, manage stress, and using principles from your research?
First of all, I welcome you all to visit Reverie, R-E-V-E-R-I. The website is www.reverie.com. You can download it from the App Store if you have an iOS phone, or from Google Play if you have an Android, and give it a try. First week is free. It is not very expensive anyway, and it's a way of trying it out and seeing if you like it. And one of our most popular applications is for stress management. And what we have people do is put themselves into a state of self-hypnosis, and you get to hear my mellifluous voice anytime you want, day or night, giving you these instructions. And it's interactive. It's the only interactive app where I give you an instruction. I ask you, is your hand floating in the air? If it is, we go on to something else. If not, you get an instruction to how to better produce that particular change. And so it's as much like the experience of being in my office as I could make it. And so what we have you do if you're dealing with stress is imagine you're floating in a bath, a lake, a hot tub, or floating in space. Get your body comfortable. We sometimes do a breath work exercise called cyclic sighing along with it, where you inhale, and you can try this and see how this feels, Ariana. Just inhale through your nose, starting with your abdomen. So diaphragmatic inhale. Now hold. Now expand your chest, fill your lungs completely, and then very slowly exhale through your mouth. And try it again. Inhale through your nose, starting with your abdomen. Now fill your lungs with your chest expanding, and slow exhale through your mouth. How's your body feeling now?
Really relaxed.
Isn't that nice? So you see how quickly and easily you can do this. Uh-huh. So now look up again, close your eyes. Imagine you're floating in a bath, a lake, a hot tub, or floating in space, and then that one hand or the other float up in the air like a balloon. And that'll be your signal to yourself and to me that you're ready to concentrate. Let it rest in a comfortable upright position. And now notice how quickly and easily you're able to use your store of memories and your imagination to help yourself and your body feel better. Picture an imaginary screen, like a movie screen, a TV screen, or a piece of clear blue sky. And picture on it a pleasant scene, somewhere you enjoy being. What do you see on the screen now?
Beautiful, lush meadow covered with flowers and green grass.
Great. So notice again how you can help your mind and your body feel better very quickly. Mm-hmm. Now, please keep your body floating and comfortable. Divide the screen in half. And on the left side, picture one thing that's causing you stress right now. But with the rule that no matter what's on the screen, you keep your body floating and comfortable. So what do you see on the left side of the screen?
Illness, somebody who's dealing with illness.
Oh, sorry. All right. How's your body feeling?
It feels good.
Good. So notice how you're able to face something that brings you worry and sadness, but at the same time, keep your body feeling comfortable. So that's your first step in managing your stress differently and better. Now, please use the right side of the screen as your problem-solving screen. Picture one thing you can do to help deal with, ameliorate the problem on the left. Mm-hmm. Can you share which on the right side?
Mm-hmm. Offering my resources.
Good. And can you picture that person responding to your offer of help?
Yes, I can.
And how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel good.
Good. And how's your body feeling?
Relaxed.
Good. So please notice how quickly you're able to deal with a problem that understandably causes you some stress. Figure a way to deal with it such that it helps your friend and it helps you feel better about the situation too, because you're now visualizing not just the problem, why your body's comfortable, but something you can do to ameliorate the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So now take a few moments to reflect on what this means to you in a private sense, and then we'll come out of the state of self-hypnosis together by counting backwards from 3 to 1. On 3, you'll get ready. 2, with your eyelids closed, roll up your eyes. 1, let your eyes open, hand float back down, make a fist open, and that'll be the end of the exercise. 3, 2, 1.
People need you on speed dial, Dr. Spiegel, but they have the app.
They don't have me on speed dial, but they do have me on Reverie. So
yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
Ariana, I used to worry about, is it almost as good as being in the office with me? And then I realized that if you're having trouble getting back to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, you probably don't want me in your bedroom telling you how to do it, but you've actually got me on the smartphones.
Excellent. Yeah. And I'll make sure to put all of that information in the show notes as well, Dr. Spiegel.
Good.
You've opened a lot of new pathways exploring how non-invasive therapies like hypnosis can alter how a patient feels, how a patient actually does, as well as care dynamics. And what are the next big questions or challenges for you that you wish to address through your research?
One of them is that we want to study systematically how well people respond to administration of hypnosis remotely with Reverie. And so far, it's looking as though 4 out of 5 people feel better within the first 10 minutes, which is pretty good. But we're analyzing large amounts of data, and we want to have published evidence about how well it works. So for stress, as you mentioned, for insomnia, for pain, for habit control like smoking, we're finding that 1 out of 4 people stop smoking after they use it, and the rest tend to reduce their average cigarette use. And so we want to learn more about that and what are the factors that can improve that. And we're also going to be working with this, with transcranial magnetic stimulation, and see if we can improve our ability to enhance hypnotizability and help more people be able to benefit as well.
Outstanding. And one more question I have was, as you, as also we, the public, continue to, as you uncover more, we continue to learn more about the brain through all of these neuroscientific advances that seem to be speeding up. There's everything is going at a faster pace. So we also are venturing into pretty complex ethical territories, especially when we look at modifying mental states and memories with tools like hypnosis or upcoming neurotechnologies. What ethical considerations do you think are imperative for whether it's psychiatrists or neuroscientists to address as we develop and then also implement these powerful neuromodulatory techniques?
They're important, but I'll tell you, the way I think of this, Ariana, is that there are a big ethical problems about the way we've been doing it until now. People are underutilizing hypnosis for pain control, for example. And there are randomized trials showing that it's useful for both acute and chronic pain. But we're getting people addicted to opioids. There were 88,000 opioid overdose deaths in the United States last year. Most of them are not suicides. They're accidental overdoses from people who have been made addicted. And you know the Purdue Pharma story where OxyContin was marketed to get people hooked on it. And it's horrifying. The CDC is predicting 111,000 deaths this year. So there are ethical problems about doing things the way we've been doing them. And I'm a doctor. I use medication. Sometimes it's wonderful. It can be life-saving. But sometimes it's the wrong choice. And so one of the ethical problems is recognizing that these intangible, non-incision injection or ingestion treatments can be as effective or more effective and safer than the things we're doing now. And so for me, the ethics involve not just the new exploring and evaluating the new treatments, but the balance between helping people learn to use this 3-pound organ on top of their bodies to better control them versus medication or surgery or other things that sometimes is not the best thing to do.
Absolutely. And that's an incredible legacy that you've already built, Dr. Spiegel. And the app is certainly an exciting extension of everything that you've worked on. Are there any other future projects that you are willing to share with us right now?
I'll tell you, my main project, Ariana, is Reverie. It's my legacy project. I've used hypnosis with a lot of people, but at some point I won't be able to anymore. And I want this to be available to not just hundreds of thousands, but millions of people who can benefit from it with very low risk and very rapid efficacy. And I want to see that happen. I'm devoting a whole lot of time and energy to perfecting Reverie, to doing more to make it better, but also to get the word out to people that they can and should try it and see how much it can help them.
Outstanding. And I am so grateful for all the work you've done, for also giving us access to this incredible tool. You've already mentioned the app, of course, and also reverie.com. Again, I'll make sure to put that in the show notes. If people would like to connect with you or learn more about it, are there any other ways to do, Dr. Spiegel?
Yes, we have information about Reverie and about the science behind Reverie. We've got lists of publications and studies we've done in different areas that you can read about on www.reverie.com, and download the app and try it. from the App Store or Google Play and see what it feels like for you. It's an opportunity, and I hope as many people as possible will take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Thank you so much,
Dr.
I'm very grateful you joined us today.
Happy to do it. Thank you so much for having me, Ariana.
Hey, everyone. If you're as passionate about transforming your life and reaching your peak performance as I am, I invite you to join my newsletter. Think of it as your weekly dose of inspiration and knowledge to supercharge your journey to becoming superhuman. Start optimizing mentally, physically, and spiritually today. Just head over to superhumanize.com/newsletter and sign up. Trust me, your future self will thank you.